May it please the court, my name is Ted Rosen, registration 18098, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Edward Cudahy, who's with me at council table. And I wanted to thank you for your time this afternoon and in considering what both parties, I'm sure, believe is a very important matter.
Ask your question before you get into the merits.
Yes.
There was some reference in the record to there being some type of a merger involving ITI. Let me ask you, does ITI still exist as a corporation?
It does still exist, Your Honor.
And are the same three, the two plaintiffs and the defendants, still the sole shareholders and the sole directors?
If I could have a moment, I believe the answer to that is in the affirmative, but before I say that on the record.
Why don't you turn off the clock for a minute while he checks with his client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting, but I just wanted to get that clear.
That's okay. And in that same vein, I want to give just some brief background about the business. The business is involved in trucking transportation, essentially, and has been in existence for quite some time. Really, in 2003, that's when the current corporate ownership structure took place. That's when the three principals of ITI, who had previously been equal shareholders, owning one-third of the company apiece, decided to change that ownership structure so that Mr. Cudahy became the two-thirds owner of the company, and the other two principals, respectively, had their interest reduced to 18% and 15%.
That share percentage still apply?
It does, Your Honor.
So were those negotiations, I take it they took place at arm's length, and they both had counsel, or... when they redid the agreement?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I know there was counsel who assisted in the transaction. I do not know if any of the principals had their own independent counsel advising them. So I don't know the answer to the specific question that you raise. But 2003 was important because that's when the parties executed two corporate documents that are at issue in this appeal, among other things, the shareholder agreement and the consent agreement also, which adopted essentially as a corporate formality the terms of the shareholder agreement.
You know who drafted the shareholder agreement, which is, I think, kind of what Judge Romano was getting at?
I do not know who drafted the shareholder agreement.
Did you argue in the court below that the agreement should be construed in any way against the draftsman, or did either side argue that?
We didn't, Your Honor. If I can have another moment, because my client may recall the name of the attorney.
If you didn't argue that it should be construed against the draftsman, I guess it doesn't really matter to me who drafted.
It may only miss point, because it raised the issue of whether, if the terms of the agreement were ambiguous, whether or not the testimony of the lawyer who drafted the agreement might have been of some assistance to the court in trying to resolve these what we've alleged are some type of inconsistencies between them. So if I can have a moment. Yes, Your Honor, again, I apologize for stepping away. It was originally the Camlett Shepherd firm that assisted the parties, and then one of the primary lawyers at that firm left, a gentleman named Rob Houston, and Mr. Houston, when he left, took the file with him and assisted the parties in completing that process. So Mr. Houston, who I actually spoke to before trial to see if he was available to testify, is that person. I think he was representing the corporation in the transaction. You're welcome. No problem. I want to focus on one of the several issues that we raised, because I think the briefs probably address it better than I can orally. But the one issue I really want to focus on is the last one that's raised about whether or not Mr. Cudahy had the ability to appoint two additional directors to the board. Because practically speaking, if he was able to appoint two additional directors, and those directors were going to be his wife and his son, he would be in a position where it would be a 3-2, assuming that the two other principals would be resistant to what the majority shareholder wanted to accomplish. So in that vein, I think the court's attention has been drawn to Section 11 of the shareholder agreement. And that provision in the agreement is, unfortunately, less than a model of clarity. It is, Your Honor, but if it is ambiguous, then it's our position that there should have been an opportunity for the appellant to present evidence on how that ambiguity should be resolved.
Saying it's your position that it's not ambiguous. His question was, is your position it's not ambiguous, and you say it is. Your position is it's not ambiguous.
That is correct, okay. Your Honor. That is correct.
I asked the question. On that point, my recollection is that in the record it shows that the trial court said, I think I understand the party's positions, and I don't think there's any more evidence that can be presented on that. That was at the close of the plaintiff's case, and that Mr. Cudahy's counsel responded, I think that's correct from our position, Your Honor. So doesn't that pretty much waive your right to now contend that there should have been more evidence received?
It does not, and that counsel was me, Your Honor. And the point I was making to the court was that there is no other evidence from the presentation that the court had received up to date, which was just the plaintiff's case at that point, that we wish to put on. In other words, we had a full and fair opportunity to cross-examine both of the principals and ask them about what we consider to be the some of the conflicts in trying to read these provisions, and there wasn't anything else that we needed to do to obtain information from the court in that regard. But when the court, during his order, said that he viewed the agreement as awkward but not ambiguous, then the transcript, and it starts at page 34 and goes on for some length through like page 43, I gently, I don't want to say interrupt, but Judge Berry was very, very, very nice courtroom to practice in. He was willing to listen to us, and I presented it's almost as an offer of proof, what the evidence might show that would establish his conclusion the document was unambiguous, was incorrect. But I think Judge Berryhill felt that although the language may have been a little bit awkward, he was able to figure out for himself what he thought it meant.
So pre-trial that it was not ambiguous and preclude you from putting on parole evidence?
He did not.
So whatever opportunity you had to put on evidence, you did up to the point where he said, I've heard enough, right?
No, because he ruled as essentially a directed verdict after the end of the plaintiff's case.
Against the plaintiff. Well, it's partly for the plaintiff, partly against the plaintiff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we didn't have the opportunity to present any type of evidence to show that the documentation created an ambiguity. I mean, it's a little unusual in my experience, and he did it, I think, pursuant to Rule 41. Or maybe I asked him to do it pursuant to 41, and he did it pursuant to Rule 43.
To ask? I mean, I think I kind of read my notes, which are pretty much what the transcript said. Did you ask at any point to say, Your Honor, before you make a final ruling, we want to present our evidence? I didn't see that in the record.
Without going back through the transcript, I don't want to represent to the court that I made that clear request to Judge Berryhill. So when I look at Section 11 of the shareholders agreement, there are really two separate paragraphs, paragraph A and paragraph B, relating to the, and this is important, to the election of directors. And what Judge Berryhill found was that because in the last sentence of Section B, because it said that any of the existing shareholders have to vote their stock so that any director who is no longer a shareholder shall be removed as a director, he read that to encompass not only the only three existing directors of the company, but also the additional directors that Judge Berryhill also found my client had the right to appoint by virtue of his status as a majority shareholder. And of course, the difficulty, practically speaking, in doing that was that Judge Berryhill found, since there was a 70% supermajority vote required to issue shares to anybody other than the three existing principals, while my client had the right in theory to appoint directors 4 and 5 as he wanted to, he didn't have the right to do that unless those directors were also shareholders. And of course, those people couldn't become shareholders absent the approval of the 33% minority shareholders because of the 70% supermajority request.
So they effectively had a veto.
They effectively had a veto. And it's an important observation, Your Honor, because when you read through the shareholder agreement and the bylaws, importantly, they unambiguously provide that the majority shareholder has the right to modify the bylaws, change the bylaws. And that unequivocal right is rendered moot and meaningless if, in fact, it can never be exercised absent the consent of the minority shareholders.
Do you agree that this agreement modified the bylaws? Both parties, all parties agree that this agreement was effective to modify the bylaws, right?
We agree, Your Honor, that to the extent it's inconsistent with the bylaws, it's inconsistent with them. But you raise an important point also, an important corporate governance point, because the company is actually to be governed by the Articles of Incorporation and the bylaws. The shareholder agreement is just a fancy word for a contract. If there is a violation of the contract, then the parties to the contract have their legal remedies available to them.
In other words, can't you enter into a contract to operate according to the contract as opposed to operating by the bylaws? All the shareholders agree to that? Isn't that allowed by both Indiana law and Colorado law, whichever governs?
It's certainly allowed by Colorado law, but to the extent that there are provisions in the shareholders agreement which are consistent with the bylaws, and other provisions that, when read in the manner that Judge Berryhill read them, are inconsistent and violate the provisions of the bylaws, in contrast to reading those same provisions in the shareholder agreement in a manner that's consistent with the bylaws, then that's not an appropriate way to interpret those two documents when they're working together.
Well, then the bylaws don't allow the directors to be added absent an amendment to the bylaws. That's what I read in the bylaws. If this is not an amendment to the bylaws, then that expansion is not effective, isn't it?
It's effective. The provision,
the authorization to expand, it seems to be ineffective because it contradicts the bylaws.
No, because the bylaws are silent on expanding the directors. In other words, the agreement in the shareholders agreement is not inconsistent.
It says in the bylaws the number of directors may be increased or decreased by an amendment to these bylaws.
Is
this an amendment to these bylaws, this agreement?
I think that to the extent that the shareholders agreement increased the number of directors from 3 to 5, that acts to modify or to amend the bylaws.
So they, by agreement, they could supersede the bylaws. I'm sorry.
That's certainly a fair question.
Council, I noticed, you know, there is specific statute both in Colorado and Indiana providing that shareholders can enter into an agreement in which they agree and bind themselves to vote their shares in a certain way, however they agree, and that is specifically enforceable. Now, neither party cited that, but doesn't that kind of trump this whole argument about what the bylaws say? Because regardless of what the bylaws say, the parties are saying, we agree, we're going to vote our shares in this way.
Oh, so let me agree with that for purposes of this argument, and then take that observation a step further. If that is true, that still doesn't apply to the provision in the last sentence of paragraph B on section 11, because that sentence relates only to the existing directors. That sentence, there is nowhere in the shareholder agreement that says, and Judge Berryhill actually asked one of the other principals, where in the shareholder agreement does it say that a new director has to be a shareholder? And the response that Judge Berryhill got was, it doesn't expressly say that, but, and then Judge Berryhill interrupted and asked, or does it implicitly say that?
What about the last sentence? It says, each of the shareholders shall vote all of the stock owned or held of record by such shareholder so that any director, not the foregoing three, but any director who is no longer a shareholder shall be removed as a director.
Because that's a removal provision. That's not an election provision.
No, but you have to vote your shares to remove them so you can, so under your theory, he could have these people appointed, elect them for a couple of days until there's a shareholder meeting where they're removed. Is that the procedure?
That's not, Your Honor. Although I understand the logical progression of that argument, the response is that last sentence, when read in harmony with 11A, relates only to the three existing directors.
Why does it say any director?
Because it is a removal provision. And at that time, the only directors were the three existing directors. Thank you.
I have one more question. Ask you this. Does the shareholder agreement violate either state's public policy?
Well, I think it may, Your Honor, because the Colorado public policy is that the majority shareholder has the rights under the law to control the actions of the company to the extent that the majority shareholder, you know, has those rights. And that's, I'm not going to quote it, but I couldn't find a Colorado case, but that's a principle that was recognized by the two Delaware Chancery Court cases, which we cite on page 34 of our opening brief.
So you have the right to bargain away that right? And isn't that what your client did here?
He probably does have the right to bargain.
Isn't that what your client did here? I mean, admittedly, he got the right to expand the board, but then he gave up the right to appoint new board members other than, according to Judge Berryhill, except for people who were shareholders.
Right. And if Judge Berryhill is right, then he could bargain that away. But under the language in this agreement, it's apparent, I believe it's apparent that he didn't bargain away that right, and if it's not apparent, then it's certainly at a minimum ambiguous about whether he bargained away that right. Thank you.
Extra 2 minutes.
I won't need that.
If you need it.
For the record, my name is Victor Boog. My attorney number is 2561. I'll be here on behalf of Mr. Egan and Mr. Ingram, who were present. One of the questions that was asked was, who drafted this document? And from the record on page 5 of my answer brief, I state, according to the testimony of Dwight Ingram, the language in the shareholders agreement was created by Frederick Egan, Edward Cudahy, and himself, and I cite to the transcript where that testimony was presented to the court. So if there was an attorney involved, it didn't come out in this hearing before Judge Berryhill. And there was no evidence in terms of documentary evidence that I recall that would have indicated an attorney was intimately involved in the preparation of this shareholders agreement.
Your position that the agreement was ambiguous? Your client's position.
My position is that under the case law in Colorado, a judge has the right to listen to extrinsic evidence in making a determination of whether the judge thinks it's ambiguous or not. And if it's determined by the judge to be ambiguous, then of course he can look at the facts and circumstances surrounding the creation of this document. If he decides that it's black and white, and he applies some four corners test, which isn't really favored, I think, under Colorado law, then, of course, he should disregard any of this extrinsic evidence. In this case, I think what the judge did was he looked at the circumstances surrounding the creation of this document back in 2003. And at that time, as counsel has already stated, these were equal partners, each having a third of this company. And this document, the shareholders agreement, when you look at it, Judge Berryhill determined that it was a document to protect minority shareholders, as my clients were to become. And when you look at the purpose of the agreement in paragraph 1, that certainly is expressed therein. And when you look at exhibits or paragraphs 1, 2, and 3, there are very strict restrictions on the transfer of stock by any of these people, requiring a 70% agreement to do so. So, for example, you can't even give it by gift to your son or your daughter or your wife and then put them on the board under that scenario. And I think that's what convinced the judge in this case at the trial court level that the document, and I don't know that he necessarily said it was ambiguous, but he did refer to extrinsic evidence. So perhaps either he was hedging his bet or he looked at what he heard and it influenced them in some degree.
What do you want us to do?
I want you to affirm, of course. I think extrinsic evidence would be appropriate in this case, given the facts and circumstances and context in which this was created.
Your position that the judge in reaching the extrinsic evidence said that he found?
I think he said, if he said he found it not ambiguous, I missed that. And
it was awkward, but not ambiguous.
Okay, I you're right. I'll leave that up to this board to decide. You're much brighter about this than I am.
Let me ask you a question, so we get right to it, about this section 11.
Yes.
Which is titled the election of directors. I think you certainly agree that the second sentence of that protects the right of your clients to remain on the board. The following persons at a minimum are elected, and if they desire to remain, they remain on the board. That's your position, and you won that point before Judge Berryhill.
Yes, right? And in fact, it was admitted by Mr. Rosen during his colloquy with the judge himself.
They're appealing that, but they ask us to reverse that, but you certainly support that position.
I certainly support that position, and the next sentence
then says, if there shall be more than three directors, the remaining directors shall be elected by a majority vote. And Judge Berryhill ruled that there could be more than three directors, notwithstanding whatever the bylaws said.
Right.
And that the remaining directors could be elected by a majority vote. And that's contrary to your client's interest, but you aren't cross-appealing that ruling, are you?
I'm not cross-appealing that ruling because he went on to say that in his opinion,
they have to be shareholders. So let's look at the last sentence. Each of the shareholders shall vote all of the stock owned or held of record by such shareholders, so that. Now, that language is exactly the same as the sentence above that protects your client's right to stay on the board, right?
Yes.
It's exactly the same introductory wording, exactly. Except it then says any director who is no longer a shareholder shall be removed. Why isn't that just the opposite side of the coin? They have the right to stay on the board. They have to vote their stock that way. And if they are no longer a shareholder, they're off the board, and everybody has to vote their stock that way. Why isn't there just two sides of the coin?
Well, if you're no longer a shareholder, you're off the board. You're absolutely right.
Why is that interpreted non-share? Why does it mean anything more than that, I guess is what I'm saying? Why does it
non-shareholders? As Judge Miller indicated, if you wanted it to apply only to the three named shareholders, you could have said so. But it says any director.
No longer mean.
No longer, he said, was awkward language, and it could have been better language, could have been more direct, but when he looked at the overall purpose of this shareholders agreement, it became clear to him, at least, that this was intended to make sure that, first of all, you had to be a shareholder to be a director, and if you were not a shareholder any longer, you could no longer be a director. The irony in this case is that when this case was pled, Mr. Rosen and his counsel answered that both Mrs. Cudahy and Mr. Cudahy's son were shareholders. But when we got to trial, they acknowledged that they weren't shareholders then. Now, whether they were actually made shareholders and then removed somehow, I'm not sure. But it was interesting to me that that's how it was pled to begin with. And that pleading was never changed.
But there's no question that this agreement never vote by 70% of the shareholders to make them shareholders.
There was no right to make them shareholders.
And that provision of the agreement is certainly not before us, and that's
true. That's true. I think that the court is well versed in what's at issue here, and I don't know that there's much more I can tell you to convince you one way or the other.
Counsel, is there anything in the extrinsic evidence that would help shed light on what's meant by no longer a shareholder in provision 11B?
Yeah. Both my clients testified that it was their intention when they entered into this agreement, and it was their belief that the language utilized by lay people was sufficient to satisfy the requirement that you had to be a shareholder to be a director. Both my clients testified to that effect. And what's interesting about this case is that Mr. Cudahy also testified in this case during my case in chief. And he was asked a whole series of questions about this shareholders agreement. And that's why when the judge said, I don't think I need any more testimony about this, he was able to say that because he'd already heard Mr. Cudahy's view of this matter, as well as my clients.
Mr. Cudahy, agree with your client's view on the meaning of no longer a shareholder in 11B?
Here's what he said, and I think I put it in my brief. He started by saying, he acknowledged that it was agreed to by the parties, the shareholders agreement, even though it wasn't signed, but it was ratified. And he went on to say, this is the agreement we had worked off of since 2003. So this was an agreement that had been in effect for 6 years or more. And there was only three shareholders during all that time. And there were only three members of the board all that time. So on a practice and performance basis, that's how these parties had proceeded under this document.
He wasn't asked, what is the meaning of the phrase no longer in paragraph 11? Yeah. He didn't answer that question.
What he did answer was, I take the same position that they do, meaning my clients, as far as the document is concerned. Those were his words. But when I asked him a more direct question, whether he had an opinion regarding whether or not the shareholders agreement required a director of ITI, to be a shareholder of ITI, he responded, I do not. I don't take a position on it. My clients obviously did take a position on it for what it was worth.
It's true, however, that the bylaws do not require a director to be the directors to be shareholders, right? The bylaws don't require that.
They may not. But to me, this document, the bylaws were adopted in 1996. This was 2003, and there was never any change after this, and I think this is the binding contract.
This contract basically modified the bylaws. That's what I started with,
yes,
Mr. Rosen.
I think it
did. Thing, and modified the bylaws, superseded the bylaws.
Well, one of the other things that's interesting about this is that this shareholders agreement expressly states that the agreement itself is controlled by Colorado law. The irony is that for Mr. Cudahy is that under Indiana law, directors control a company. So the two directors out of three have control even beyond the control of a majority shareholder under Indiana law. So that's why Mr. Cuddy is here today, because he realizes that he doesn't have carte blanche authority to do whatever he wants just because he's a majority shareholder. And this whole case came up in the context of actions being taken, in our opinion, by Mr. Cuddy that were not only in violation of my client's rights, but in violation of the company's interests as well. And it had ramifications beyond just ITI. It had ramifications for AAA, which was consisting of a California company, and ITI, the Indiana company.
What is the ownership relationship between ITI and the
company? The ITI and the other company from California each had basically a 50% interest in this umbrella company. The umbrella company does all the work. ITI just sits there as a shell.
Owner of
it? Yes. And there are four managers of that company, two from each of the two companies. And what happened was is that there was a big mess in AAA, which led to a big lawsuit against Mr. Cudahy, where he had taken hundreds of thousands of dollars without authority from the master company or the merged company. And as a result of that, he was sued. And he wanted to basically set up a situation where he could dump Mr. Egan and Mr. Ingram as directors of ITI. He could then install his wife and son, and then he could somehow cause Mr. Egan, who was also a manager, one of the four managers of the other company, to be thrown out as a manager. He could put in his wife in that capacity. Then it would be two against two, and this master company couldn't sue anybody, and he'd be free to do whatever he pleased. And that's what precipitated this all this litigation beginning in September of 2009.
Well, look, stands now. Corporate ownership has not changed.
Yes. Yes. Nobody else is on the board.
I have a question.
Yes.
Berryhill allowed them to expand the board from 3 to 5, right?
He basically said, you can expand it right now, but then you have to turn right around and get them off because they're not shareholders.
Oh, you can expand the number of directors permitted from 3 to 5.
Yes.
And so those seats remain vacant.
They remain vacant.
So it's kind of a meaningless act on the part of Mr. Cudahy.
He didn't accomplish anything. He tried to put his wife and son on the board.
Can anybody else be put on there?
Oh, yeah.
If somebody approves transfer shares.
Right. For example, if there was somebody who was a big investor and wanted to be part of this company and was a person that everybody agreed would be a great addition, they could probably be on there tomorrow.
So as things stand, it's just that the size of the board is 5, there's 2 vacancies.
Right. Right. My client's concern was not that there might be another shareholder who became a shareholder and was on the board. It was that they didn't want his son or his wife, who literally know nothing about this business, coming on this board and then doing his.
But to go back to your hypothetical, the big investor that everybody would get excited about and want to add would also have to be given some shares, isn't that right?
Right. But if he's an investor, then normally, unless he's just going to give you a loan, he'd have some shares. And then, of course, if he had some shares, Mr. Cudahy could put him on in an instant. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the arguments from both counsel. The case has been submitted and will be a decision will be forthcoming in due course.